Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Freaks and Geeks. I am your geeky guide tonight. If you are new to us, and if you've been with us for a while, please go ahead and do us a favor. Head on over to Facebook and give us a like. I am joined, as always, by my dear, dear friend extraordinaire, Carrie, and my husband, Chris.
Hello, hello.
Oh, yeah, it's good to be back.
Oh, wow. Chris, you sound so different on the phone.
I have my headset on because I'm doing it in the office and not on my laptop in the living room.
Well, you don't sound quite as dulcet, I'll tell you that.
Well, my dulcet tones will be back next week.
Oh. Well, I am joining us from the far distant land of D.C., so I am calling in tonight, and let's pray that the Blog Talk gods are with us so that we can get through this episode in a successful manner. Yes, everyone?
Fingers crossed.
I've already sacrificed plenty of chicken wings.
Plenty of chicken wings. I'll take it. So tonight we're going to get into the Knights Templar and the Freemasons, and we are going to do the hell out of that after the jump. Everyone, welcome back. If you're here with us, you're here for the Knights Templar and the Freemasons and the Paranormal episode, and we would like to welcome you for sure. This past weekend, I had the honor of hanging out with RTL at the Gnomes House investigation in Smithfield. We actually had some really interesting things happen there. We had a lot of really interesting K2 play, and then we also had some people that had some very personal experiences and made almost all of us emotional, actually, just there was a gentleman there whose daughter had passed away a while ago, and he asked some burning questions and got some real answers while he was there. And then there was another father that was there, and something happened, and his keychain, this keychain that he had that was a it was like a seashell, broke off when he was like walking downstairs or something like that. And the father, so this one father that had the keychain, felt like it was a sign that he was supposed to give the part of the keychain that broke off to this father that had lost his daughter. Now, he didn't know why he felt that way, but he gave it to the guy, and then the guy got really affected by it, and he said the last place that he and his daughter were supposed to go was to the beach. So that was really crazy. That was amazing. I'm so glad I was there for it. We had 5 charities going that we were gathering money for all night, and I think it was a pretty lucrative night for them. So it was just a great event all around. Anytime we get to hang out with RTL, it's a great event. So, Carrie, I know you have been doing some research on the Evergreen Cemetery soldiers that have lost their plot. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
So always doing research. We a couple of weeks ago, you know, we did the flag placing at Evergreen and East End Cemeteries just outside of Richmond, Virginia. And Dennis showed us that they had 5 VA-issued tombstones leaned and in a place of honor against a tree, because a couple of years ago, Wounded Warriors had come out and done a cleanup event there, found them just stacked in a pile, overgrown, and they couldn't figure out where these soldiers are buried. And one of them served in World War I and World War II, 3 others in World War II, and then 1 in Korea. So I love a challenge, and said, you know, I'd like to try to research them, see if we can find their death certificates, where they're buried, or at least the funeral home that took care of them after they passed should be on their death certificates, so I can use that information to try to find the cemetery that they belong in. So I have located all of the death certificates.
Have you? I thought it was only 2.
I found the others. 4 of the 5 are listed as being in Evergreen. The 5th one is actually buried in a church cemetery in Powhatan.
Oh, wow. I wonder where they got that tombstone from.
Well, he has another marker there in that tomb, in that cemetery, another VA marker. So 2 were issued. Maybe there was some sort of miscommunication or something. I'm not sure what happened with that. 1 is buried in Evergreen, and I have a pretty good lead on where he is at because I found his wife. And then I have funeral home information for the other 3, and those other 3, the funeral homes are still in business, so I'm going to follow up with them and see if they have any information about where in the cemetery their final resting place is.
That is fantastic. That is just, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to go out there and restore as much as humanly possible. So that's fantastic. Thank you for working so hard on that.
Yeah,
that
I really
am. That Carrie will find you no matter what.
Yeah, Carrie will find you. Carrie's one of the
I will find you, and I will make sure that your marker is placed on your final resting place.
Yes.
So,
all right.
I wanted to say before we got into tonight's topic, I've been listening to some Jack the Ripper episodes on some podcasts because that's what I do, and it's one of my favorite stories. And I know it's probably not true, but the conspiracy theory with the Knights Templar and Jack the Ripper, I would hope it to be true, but unfortunately I don't believe it is. But Just fun historical facts with the Knights, or not the Knights, but the Freemasons.
What show are you talking about?
It's the conspiracy where the Jack the Ripper murders were part of a huge Masonic ritual to show the Masonic brothers around the world that the Masons were still in power, being that the Masons were part of the establishment in London, and the establishment wasn't wasn't doing well. It wasn't popular amongst the people, and so the theory is that Sir William Gull was ordered to carry out the Jack the Ripper murders and used it to show the world that the Masons still had a firm control of, you know, seats of power.
Well, that's special.
It goes right in. It goes along with the royal conspiracy to where, you know, one of the princes had an illegitimate child with a Catholic woman. Then they used the murders to cover up, you know, evidence of that child being born, and then they just turned it into a Masonic ritual.
Well, I don't think that the two are related. As we get into the information tonight, you will see that there is kind of a big overlap in anti-Semitism, which was also a big player in the Jack the Ripper case, and anti-Masonism.
Masonics.
Yeah,
sure. That sounds about right.
Let's go for it. Okay, so our episode tonight, if you haven't guessed, is the Knights Templar and the Freemasons. Harry, you want to kick us off with a little bit of history?
Always. So the history of the Order of the Knights Templar as a transnational military religious order, try saying that two times fast, spans two centuries of the High Middle Ages, from the order's founding in the early 12th century to its suppression early in the 14th century. The Knights Templar trace their origin back to shortly after the First Crusade. Around 1119, a French nobleman, Hugues de Payens, collected eight knights, including Godfrey de Saint-Omer, and began the order, their stated mission to protect pilgrims on their journey to visit the holy places. They approached King Baldwin II of Jerusalem, who allowed them to set up headquarters on the Temple Mount. The Dome of the Rock, at the center of the mount, was understood to occupy the site of the Jewish temple. Known to Christians throughout the Muslim occupation of Jerusalem as the Holy of Holies, the Dome of the Rock became a Christian church, the Templum Domini, the Temple of the Lord. But the Templars were lodged in the Aqsa Mosque, which was assumed to stand on the site of Solomon's Temple. Because the Aqsa Mosque was known as the Templum Solomonis, it was not long before the Knights had encompassed the association into their name. They became known as the Paupers Commilitones Christi Templique Solomonici, the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ, and of the Temple of Solomon, which was eventually shortened to the Knights Templar. The original order consisted of Hugues de Payens and eight knights, two of whom were brothers and all of whom were his relatives by either blood or marriage. Godfrey de Saint-Omer, Payne de Monteverdi, Archambault de Saint-Agnan, André de Montbard, Geoffrey Besson, and two men recorded only by the names of Rosal and Gondomer. The ninth knight remains unknown, although some have speculated that it was Count Hugh of Champagne himself, despite the count returning to France in 1116 and documentary evidence showing that he joined the knights on his third visit to the Holy Land in 1125. Little was heard of the order for the first 9 years, but in 1129, after they were officially sanctioned by the church at the Council of Troyes, they became well known in Europe. Their fundraising campaigns asked for donations of money, land, or noble-born sons to join the order, with the implication that donations would help both to defend Jerusalem and to ensure the charitable giver of a place in heaven. The order's efforts were helped substantially by the patronage of Bernard of Clairvaux, the leading churchman of the time, and a nephew of one of the original nine knights. The order at its outset had been subject to strong criticism, especially of the concept that religious men could also carry swords. In response to these critics, the influential Bernard of Clairvaux wrote a multi-page treatise entitled In Praise of the New Knighthood, in which he championed their mission and defended the idea of a military religious order by appealing to the long-held Christian theory of just war, which legitimized taking up the sword to defend the innocent and the church from violent attack. In doing so, Bernard legitimized the Templars, who became the first warrior monks of the Western world. Bernard wrote, "A Templar knight is truly a fearless knight and secure on every side, for his soul is protected by the armor of faith, just as his body is protected by the armor of steel. He is thus doubly armed and need fear neither demons nor men." In 1139, upon the order by Pope Innocent II, who issued a papal bull, it was stated that the Knights Templar could pass freely through any border, owed no taxes, and were subject to no one's authority except that of the Pope. It was a remarkable confirmation of the Templars and their mission, which may have been brought about by the order's patron, Bernard of Clairvaux, who had helped Pope Innocent in his own rise. The order grew rapidly throughout Western Europe, with chapters appearing in France, England, and Scotland, and then spreading to Spain and Portugal.
Well, they spread quickly, that's for sure.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, did we already lose April? The gods of Blog Talk not being kind today?
I'm here. I'm not dead yet.
Oh,
I've got 17% battery. We're good. No, that's really crazy. It makes me think of the Three Musketeers. Were they Templars? How does that work?
I don't think they were Templars. I think they were more they were supposed to be like the King's Guard, is what their story is supposed to be.
Yeah, but didn't they have big ass crosses on their like vests or whatever?
They did.
Isn't that kind of?
Well, my limited knowledge of the Three Musketeers, I don't think the Templars, like, they officially associating them with the Knights Templar ever actually came up. But,
it's,
I mean,
it does feature the Templar cross, though.
Maybe it's just a popular symbol and they liked it.
Oh my gosh, Christopher. Stop.
I don't know. I certainly maybe. Oh, you know what? That is like a kind of thing. It's maybe not directly that they were Templars, but sort of like a
religious fighting force.
Certainly a religious fighting force, but sort of like a theme, thematically, very Templar-y, but not necessarily that's what they were. Kind of, they were the same mind.
Yeah. Well, I guess moving into their fight, their military. The Knights Templar were the elite fighting force of their day, highly trained, well equipped, and highly motivated. One of the tenets of their religious order was that they were forbidden from retreating from battle, unless outnumbered 3-1, and even then only by order of their commander, or if the Templar flag went down. Not all Knights Templar were warriors, though. The mission of most of the members was one of support, to acquire resources for which could be used to help fund and equip the small percentage of members who were fighting on the front lines. So, like, I guess logistics. There were actually three classes within the orders. The highest class was the knight. I can't read. When a candidate was sworn into the order, the initiation made the knight a monk, and they wore white robes. The knights could hold no property and receive no private letters. He could not be married or betrothed and could not have any vow in any other order. He could not have debt more than he could pay and no infirmities. The Templar priest was similar to the modern-day military chaplain, wearing green robes. They conducted religious services, led prayers, and were assigned to record keeping and letter writing. The Templar priests always wore gloves unless they were giving Holy Communion. The mounted men-at-arms represented the most common class, and they were called brothers. They were usually assigned 2 horses each and held many positions, including guard, steward, squire, or other support vocations. As the main support staff, they wore black or brown robes, and were partially garbed in chainmail or plate mail. The armor was not as complete as the knights. Because of this infrastructure, because of this support structure, the warriors were well trained and very well armed. Even their horses were trained to fight in combat, fully armored. The combination of soldier and monk was also a powerful one. As to the Knights Templar, martyrdom in battle was one of the most glorious ways to die. Kind of going back to like Viking mythology. The Templars were also shrewd tacticians. Following the dream of Saint Bernard, who had declared that a small force under the right conditions could defeat a much larger enemy. One of the key battles in which this was demonstrated was in 1177 at the Battle of Montisard. These French names, man, we're going to have a hard time all day. The famous Muslim military leader Saladin was attempting to push forward towards Jerusalem from the south with a force of 26,000 soldiers. He had pinned the forces of Jerusalem's King Baldwin IV, about 500 knights and their supporters, near the coast at Ascalon. 80 Templar knights and their own entourage attempted to reinforce. They met Saladin's troops at Gaza, but were considered too small a force to be worth fighting. So Saladin turned his back on them and headed with his army towards Jerusalem. Once Saladin and his army had moved on, the Templars were able to join King Baldwin's forces, and together they proceeded north along the coast. Saladin made a key mistake at this point. Instead of keeping his forces together, he permitted his army to temporarily spread out and pillage various villages on their way to Jerusalem. The Templars took advantage of this low state of readiness to launch a surprise ambush directly against Saladin and his bodyguard at Montgisard near Ramla. Saladin's army was spread too thin to adequately defend themselves, and he and his forces were forced to fight a losing battle as they retreated back to the south, ending up with only a tenth of their original number. The battle was not the final one with Saladin, but it brought a year of peace for the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and the victory became heroic legend. Another key tactic of the Templars was that of the squadron charge. A small group of knights and their heavily armored warhorses would gather into a tight group which would gallop full speed at enemy lines with a determination and force of will that made it clear that they would rather commit suicide than fall back. This terrifying onslaught would frequently have the desired result of breaking a hole in the enemy lines, thereby giving the other crusader forces an advantage. So, pretty badass warriors, I'd say.
It definitely sounds like it.
Just shows you can't turn your back on a smaller opponent.
Well, okay, but here we go. So you said, mm-hmm. and I quote, even their horses were trained to fight in combat fully armed.
Yep.
How, you want to help me? Help.
As far as like that, like they continuously trained their horses, like from a young age when they could first ride their horses, they were training with their horses to be able to, you know, ride in combat, not get scared if like they saw somebody, like cut like weapons and stuff coming around them, because like if you took like a normal horse, like a normal full-grown horse, put some armor on it, first of all, it's not gonna know how to run in that armor, it's gonna be clunky and not really know how to move very well or very fast. But they are trained with all that armor on to maneuver how they need to in battle, and also not to get scared and throw their rider off. And so he's either going to get severely injured or killed from being thrown off the horse, or just left completely vulnerable to be stabbed by his opponent.
I am very skeptical, but I'll take it, only because I don't know any better at this juncture.
I kind of feel like I've seen something before about horses that were like, I don't want to say trained to fight, but yeah, like Chris said, like trained to be effective in battle, not be afraid and be able to.
Think of like, you know, the second Lord of the Rings movie where they have that huge battle at Helm's Deep, and you got Gandalf and the Rohirrim like on top of the
hill.
How
about we think about Genghis Khan and we don't think about the fictional thing? How about we do that?
Genghis Khan also, I think, if I remember rightly, his horses had some version of chainmail armor on them to sort of protect their upper body. And But their horses didn't really do too much of like running into combat. A lot of Genghis Khan was horse archers, to where they would run around the battlefield where the archers did a lot more of the damage. The horses were just a way for them to keep incredibly mobile so they couldn't get hit by their opponent.
Christopher, you were just disappointing the shit out of me tonight. I'm just going to tell you that.
I mean, I'm dropping knowledge bombs like it's freaking Hiroshima up in here.
The first full rebuttal of one of April's I call bullshit.
I'll take it. Okay, so though initially an order of poor monks, the official papal sanction made the Knights Templar a charity across Europe. Further resources came in when members joined the order, as they had to take oaths of poverty and therefore often donated large amounts of their original cash or property to the order. Sounds a lot like Three Musketeers. Since the monks themselves were sworn to poverty but had the strength of a large and trusted international infrastructure behind them, nobles would occasionally use them as a kind of bank for power of attorney. If a noble wished to join the Crusades, this might entail an absence of years from their home. So some nobles would place all of their wealth and businesses under the control of the Templars. Sounds like a terrible idea. To safeguard them until their return. The order's financial power became substantial, and the majority of the order's infrastructure was devoted not to combat, but to economic pursuits. By 1150, the order's original mission of guarding pilgrims had changed into a mission of guarding their valuables through an innovated way of issuing letters of credit, an early precursor to modern banking. Pilgrims would visit a Templar house in their home country, depositing their deeds and valuables. The Templars would then give them a letter which would describe their holdings. Modern scholars have stated these letters were encrypted with a cipher alphabet based off of the Maltese cross. Just like the Three Musketeers.
Oh my god, you are so stuck on the Three Musketeers, it's ridiculous.
You made me watch that movie. However, there is some disagreement on this, and it is possible that the code system was introduced later and not something used by medieval Templars themselves. While traveling, the pilgrims could present the letter to other Templars along the way to withdraw, quote-unquote, funds from their accounts. This kept the pilgrims safe since they were not carrying valuables and further increased the power of the Templars. The Knights' involvement in banking grew over time into a new basis for money. As Templars became increasingly involved in banking activities, one indication of their powerful political connections is that the Templars' involvement in usury did not lead to more controversy within the order and the church at large. Officially, the idea of lending money in return for the interest was forbidden by the church, but the order sidestepped this with clever loopholes such as stipulation that the Templars retained the right to production of mortgage property. Or, as one Templar researcher put it, since they weren't allowed to charge interest, they charged rent instead.
Their holdings were never crafty Templars.
They are crafty, crafty little buggers, I'll tell you. Their holdings were necessary to support their campaign. In 1180, a Burgundian noble required 3 square kilometers of estate to support himself as a knight. And by 1260, this had risen to 15.6 kilometers squared. The order potentially supported up to 4,000 horses and pack animals at any given time. If provisions to rule were followed, these horses had extremely high maintenance costs due to the heat in Altremer, which is a crusader state at the Eastern Mediterranean, and had high mortality rates due to both disease and the Turkish bowman strategy of aiming at a knight's horse rather than the knight himself, which is super smart if you think about it.
Yeah.
In addition, the high mortality rates of the knights in the East, regularly 90% in battle, not including wounded, resulted in extremely high campaign costs due to the need to recruit and retain more knights. In 1244, at the Battle of Laforbie, where only 33 of 300 knights survived, it is estimated that the financial loss was equivalent to 1/9 of the empire, Capetian yearly review. The Templars' political connections and awareness of the essentially urban and commercial nature of the Altremer communities led the order to a position of significant power. both in Europe and the Holy Land. They owned large tracts of land both in Europe and the Middle East, built churches and castles, bought farms and vineyards, were involved in manufacturing and import-export, and had their own fleet of ships, and for a time even owned the entire island of Cyprus. They did pretty well for themselves.
Yeah, I think they got too big for their britches, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, their success attracted the concern of many others, with the two most powerful rival orders being the Knights Hospitaller and the Teutonic Knights. Various nobles
also... Can I say
also,
something real quick?
Of course.
It's the Knights Hospitaller. I know that. Hospitaller.
Okay, Hospitaller.
I'm just helping you out.
What was the leader of the Muslim army? What was his name?
Yeah.
Saladin.
Talk about that.
No, Saladin.
Oh well, tomato tomato.
Okay. Now it's tomato tomato.
Yeah.
So, in addition to the Knights Hospitaller and the Teutonic Knights, various nobles also had concerns about the Templars as well, both for financial reasons and nervousness about an independent army that was able to move freely through all borders. The long-famed military acumen of the Templars began to stumble in the 1180s. On the 4th of July, 1187, came the disastrous Battle of the Horns of Hattin, a turning point in the Crusades. It again involved Saladin, who had been beaten back by the Templars in 1177 in the legendary Battle of Montesquieu near Tiberias, but this time Saladin was better prepared. Further, the Grand Master of the Templars was involved in this battle, Gerard de Ridefort, who had just achieved that lifetime position a few years earlier. He was not known as a good military strategist and made some deadly errors, such as venturing out with his force of 80 knights without adequate supplies or water across the arid hill country of Galilee. The Templars were overcome by the heat within a day and then surrounded and massacred by Saladin's army. Within months, Saladin captured Jerusalem. Then, in the early 1190s, in a remarkably short and powerfully effective campaign, Richard the Lionheart, King of England and leader of the Third Crusade, together with his allies, the Templars, delivered a series of powerful blows against Saladin and recovered much of the Christian territory. In name and number, the revived Crusader states were as before, but their outlines were diminished. There was the Kingdom of Jerusalem, though its capital was at Acre, which the Templars made their new headquarters. To the north was the County of Tripoli, but the Muslims regained control of the Syrian coast around Latakia for some time, and so the Principality of Antioch further to the north was now no longer contiguous to the other Crusader states. Nevertheless, the Third Crusade, in which Richard relied heavily on the Templars, had saved the Holy Land for the Christians and went a long way towards restoring Frankish fortunes. In this, he was abetted by the military orders, whose great castles stood like islands of Frankish power amid the Muslim torrent. More than ever, the Crusader states were relying on the military orders and their castles and on the field of battle, and the power of the orders grew. In fact, at no point in their history would the Templars be more powerful than in the century to come. But after the Siege of Acre in 1291, the Templars were forced to relocate their headquarters to the island of Cyprus. In 1298 or 1299, the military orders, the Knights Templar and the Knights Hospitaller, and their leaders, including Jacques de Molay, Aton de Grandson, and the Grand Master of the Hospitallers, briefly campaigned in Armenia in order to fight off an invasion by the Mamluks. They were not successful, and soon the fortress of Rosh Giyam in the Belen Pass, the last Templar stronghold in Antioch, was lost to the Muslims. In 1300, the Templars, along with the Knights Hospitaller and forces from Cyprus, attempted to retake the coastal city of Tortosa. They were able to take the island of Arwad near Tortosa, but lost it soon afterward. With the last of Arwad, the Crusaders had lost their last foothold in the Holy Land. Though they still had a base of operations in Cyprus and controlled considerable financial resources, the Order of the Templars became an order without a clear purpose or support, but which still had enormous financial power. This unstable situation contributed to their downfall. In the following years, the Knights Templar would be persecuted throughout Europe, having their land and wealth seized and their members arrested.
I will say, like, yeah, we can literally probably do 2 episodes just on the freaking Knights Templar. Like, there's so much information as far as...
Oh, yeah, because we're not even getting into, like, all the, like, wild and crazy stuff and, like, conspiracy theories or just theories related to them, and there's so much.
Now, as an avid fan of the Assassin's Creed game series, not so much the movie, but I've always looked at the Knights Templar as bad guys. although they didn't start out that way, they obviously looked to start out as like having a just cause and trying to make sure that pilgrims could do like make it, make their way to the holy places that they were trying to go for whatever pilgrimage they were trying to make. I think the fact that they came too big for their britches and were trying to do more than like they were needed to do.
Oh yeah, it definitely seems like it became a prestige thing more. Not that it wasn't completely no longer a service thing, but that definitely was not the most, that wasn't the focus.
No, I think it became a big thing of like, they were at the end, maybe just trying to get as much power and all that they were trying to get, like as they possibly could. And with the fact that they could just freely bumble about through any land that they wanted to, because the Pope said, hey, these guys are cool. I think definitely would make the rest of the European nations insanely uneasy that this, this army of highly trained and highly skilled warriors can just go through any land that they please without repercussion would definitely be a cause for concern.
Yeah, it's kind of...
You still with us?
What?
We didn't know if we lost it yet.
I'm here. I'm struggling along, but I'm here. Okay. So now we finally get to get into Freemasonry. So Freemasonry, or Masonry, consists of fraternal organizations that trace their origins to local fraternities of stonemasons, which from the end of the 14th century regulated the qualifications of stonemasons and their interaction with authorities and clients. The degrees of Freemasonry retain 3 grades of medieval craft guilds, those of the apprentice, journeyman, or fellow, now called fellow craft, and master mason. These are the degrees offered by craft Freemasonry, or the Blue Lodge, really, as we call it. Members of these organizations are known as Freemasons or Masons. There are additional degrees which vary with locality and jurisdiction and are usually administered by different bodies of the craft than the craft degrees. The basic local organizational unit of Freemasonry is the lodge. The lodges are usually supervised and governed at the regional level, usually coterminous with either a state, province, or national border, by a Grand Lodge or Grand Orient. There is no international worldwide Grand Lodge that supervises all of Freemasonry. Each Grand Lodge is independent, and they do not necessarily recognize each other as being legitimate. Modern Freemasonry broadly consists of 2 main recognition groups. Regular Freemasonry insists that a volume of scripture is open in a working lodge, that every member professes belief in a supreme being, and that no women are admitted, and that the discussion of religion and politics is banned. Continental Freemasonry is now the general term for liberal jurisdictions who have removed some or all of these restrictions. The Masonic Lodge is the basic organizational unit of Freemasonry, just as we talked about. The lodge meets regularly to conduct the usual formal business of any small organization, so to pay bills, organize social and charitable events, elect new members, et cetera, et cetera. In addition to business, the meeting may perform a ceremony to confer a Masonic degree or receive a lecture, which is usually on some aspect of Masonic history or ritual. At the conclusion of the meeting, the lodge might adjourn for a formal dinner or festive board, sometimes involving toasting and song. The bulk of Masonic ritual consists of degree ceremonies. Candidates for Freemasonry are progressively initiated into Freemasonry. First, the degree of Entered Apprentice. Sometime later, in a separate ceremony, they will be passed the degree of Fellowcraft. And finally, they will be raised to the degree of Master Mason. In all of these ceremonies, the candidate is entrusted with passwords, signs, and grips, particular to his new rank. Another ceremony is the annual installation of the master and the officers of the lodge. In some jurisdictions, installed master is valued as a separate rank, with its own secrets to distinguish its members. In other jurisdictions, the grade is not recognized, and no inner ceremony conveys new secrets during the installation of a new master of the lodge, really known as worshipful master. Most lodges have some sort of social calendar, allowing Masons and their partners to meet in a less ritualized environment. Often coupled with these events is some obligation placed on every Mason to contribute to charity. This occurs at both lodge and Grand Lodge levels. Masonic charities contribute to many fields, such as education or disaster relief. These private local lodges form the backbone of Freemasonry, and a Freemason will necessarily have been initiated into one of these. There also exist specialist lodges where Masons meet to celebrate events such as a sport or Masonic research. The rank of Master Mason also entitles a Freemason to explore Masonry further through other degrees administered separately from the craft or Blue Lodge degrees described here, but have a similar format to their meetings. There is very little consistency in Freemasonry. Because each Masonic jurisdiction is independent, each sets its own procedures. The wording of the ritual and the number of officers present, the layout of the meeting room, varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. The officers of the lodge are elected and appointed annually. Every Masonic lodge also has a master, two wardens, a secretary, and a treasurer. There is also a tyler, an outer guard, who is always present outside the door of a working lodge. Other officers vary by jurisdiction. Each Masonic lodge exists and operates according to a set of ancient principles known as the landmarks of Freemasonry. These principles have thus far eluded any universally accepted definition. I think it's kind of cool that I'm sitting like 5 miles right now, at this very moment. I'm sitting like 5 miles away from the George Washington Memorial Temple, like right now.
Which is a crazy, gorgeous building.
It's amazing. I need to actually go up there, but... I could probably walk to it from here, like throw a stone and hit it.
Now you're talking about the lodges. We got the ability to go and do like an investigation at one of the lodges, and it's freaking nuts. It'd be crazy to actually like see one of the ceremonies like taking place just based.
Well, I mean, Christopher, I've told you before that you just need to
I'm not going to become a Freemason.
Why?
They do murders, and it's crazy.
No. How about no?
There's a lot of, what's the word for it? There's a lot of ceremony, it seems, that goes on with it. It would be cool to see, but I mean, I'm happy not actually being a part of it. I just would like to see it. Carrie,
I guess.
Yes. Always. Freemasonry is very fascinating to me, but I'm also not particularly interested in becoming a member. Which is not which is not a jab at Freemasonry. I'm not a super social person. It seems very socially heavy.
Yes. It seems like you might need to be kind of an extrovert. I don't know,
yeah.
Freemasonry.
I mean, I'm an introvert.
You are, but you have an extrovert mask that you pull out of your pocket.
I do have an extrovert mask. Yes, you are right about that.
My extrovert mask is like that weird paper mache mask you made in third grade. Like, it's not fooling anybody.
It just easily falls right off. Like, you'd be like you'd be at like a social gathering and somebody just comes up and talks to you randomly. You're just like, I gotta go.
Yeah. They jump to the conclusion that I'm some sort of alien robot and into the cave.
What would it be like? Madam Carrie, can you come and say some words to the lodge? Ah!
Yes, that's exactly it.
We have fun here.
So, always. Candidates for Freemasonry will have met most active members of the lodge they're joining before they initiate it. Social heavy. The process varies between jurisdictions, but the candidate will typically have been introduced by a friend at a lodge social function or at some form of open evening in the lodge. In modern times, interested people often track down a local lodge through the internet. The onus is on the candidate to ask to join, as April just said. If the candidate decides to proceed, the lodge ballots on the application before he or she, depending on the Masonic jurisdiction, can be accepted. The absolute minimum requirement of any body of Freemasons is that the candidate must be free and considered to be of good character. There's usually an age requirement, varying greatly between Grand Lodges and in some jurisdictions, capable of being overridden by a dispensation from the Grand Lodge. The underlying assumption is that the candidate should be a mature adult.
Now, April, maybe you can answer this, but what does it mean by the candidate must be free? Does that just mean, like, they can't be imprisoned?
Yeah, I mean, they can't be a slave or imprisoned.
Huh. This seems like an odd... Like, I don't know, just... Because, like, you have to be present for said events. So it'd be odd that they would have to put that in there. Like, well, you can't be in jail and still get in. Although I guess that must mean that people have tried.
I don't think that it's primarily talking about jail, specifically.
Maybe, could it maybe be that since Freemasons are kind of the inheritors of the Knights Templar, maybe that is just one of the things that kind of the phrasing stuck around because people might not necessarily be slaves in the Middle Ages, but they might be serfs or indebted to someone or something like that. So maybe that's what that is referring to.
It's all of it actually. So like free is in like you're your own man, you make your own decisions, you follow, you know, like you are, you can make your own decisions. You're not owned by anyone or anything.
Okay.
Does that make sense? So, like, yes. Literally a slave, but then also, yes, indebtedness would be a big thing as well.
So, an additional requirement is most Grand Lodges require the candidate to declare a belief in a supreme being. In a few cases, the candidate may be required to be of a specific religion. The form of Freemasonry most common in Scandinavia, known as the Swedish Rite, for example, accepts only Christians. At the other end of the spectrum, liberal or continental Freemasonry, exemplified by the Grand Orient de France, does not require a declaration of belief in any deity and accepts atheists, a cause of discord within the rest of Freemasonry. During the ceremony of initiation, the candidate is expected to swear, usually on a volume of sacred text appropriate to his personal religious faith, to fulfill certain obligations as a Mason. In the course of 3 degrees, new Masons will promise to keep the secrets of their degree from lower degrees and outsiders, and to support a fellow Mason in distress, as far as practicality and the law permits. There's instruction as to the duties of a Freemason, but on the whole, Freemasons are left to explore the craft in the manner they find most satisfying. Some will further explore the ritual and the symbolism of the craft. Others will focus their involvement on the social side of the lodge, while still others will concentrate on the charitable functions of the lodge.
Well, just gotta find what suits you.
Yep.
Now, Carrie, I want to ask you, because I definitely want to get to, because we have a bunch of stuff to go through and a limited amount of time. How much do you want to go through before we get to, sort of the more modern stuff of the Freemasonry, such as, the stuff for World War II and all that kind of stuff?
I mean, I'm totally good with kind of...
Because that is some of the more interesting points, at least I think.
I do agree.
Go forth and conquer.
Go forth and conquer. Alrighty. Well, you want me to take it away?
You take it away.
Sure, go.
Oh, all right. Well, let's see here. Hold on. I just need to find the spot. I had it and now I lost it. Oh, wait. There we go. So in 1799, English Freemasonry almost came to a halt due to parliamentary proclamation in the wake of the French Revolt. The French Revolution, the Unlawful Societies Act banned any meetings of groups that required their members to take an oath or obligation. The Grand Masters of both the modern and the antient Grand Lodges called on Prime Minister William Pitt, who was not a Freemason, and explained to him that Freemasonry was a supporter of the law and lawfully constituted authority and was much involved in charitable work. As a result, Freemasonry was specifically exempted from the terms of the Act, provided that each private lodge's secretary placed with the local clerk of the peace a list of members of his lodge once a year. This continued until 1967, when the obligation of the provision was rescinded by Parliament. Freemasonry in the United States faced political pressure following the 1826 kidnapping of William Morgan by Freemasons and his subsequent disappearance. Reports of the Morgan affair, together with opposition to Jacksonian democracy, Andrew Jackson was a prominent Mason, helped fuel an anti-Masonic movement. The short-lived anti-Masonic party was formed, which fielded candidates for the presidential election of 1828 and 1832. In Italy, Freemasonry had become linked to a scandal concerning the Propaganda Du Lodge, a.k.a. P2. This lodge was chartered by the Grand Oriente d'Italia in 1877 as a lodge for visiting Masons unable to attend their own lodges. Under Lucio Gelli's leadership, in the late 1970s, P2 became involved in the financial scandals that nearly bankrupted the Vatican Bank. However, by this time, the lodge was operating independently and irregularly, as the Grand Orient had revoked its charter and expelled Gelli in 1976. Conspiracy theorists had long associated Freemasonry with the New World Order and the Illuminati, that Freemasonry as an organization is either bent on world domination or already secretly in control of world politics. Historically, Freemasonry has attracted criticism and suppression from both the politically far right, i.e. like Nazi Germany, that kind of stuff, and the far left, the former communist states in Eastern Europe. Even in modern democracies, Freemasonry is sometimes viewed with distrust. In the UK, Masons working in the justice system, such as judges and police officers, were from 1999 to 2009 required to disclose their membership, while a parliamentary inquiry found that there had been no evidence of wrongdoing. The government believes that Masons' potential loyalties to support fellow Masons should be transparent to the public. The policy of requiring a declaration of Masonic membership by applicants for judicial office, judges, and magistrates was ended in 2009 by Justice Secretary Jack Straw, who had initiated the requirement in the 1990s. Straw stated that the rule was considered disproportionate since no impropriety or malpractice had been shown as a result of judges being Freemasons. Freemasonry is both successful and controversial in France. As of the early 21st century, membership is rising, but reporting in the popular media is often negative. In some countries, anti-Masonry is often related to anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. For example, in 1980, the Iraqi legal and penal code was changed by Saddam Hussein's ruling Ba'ath Party. I assume I said that right. Making it a felony to, quote, promote or acclaim Zionist principles, including Freemasonry, or who associate themselves with Zionist organizations. Professor Andrew Prescott of the University of Sheffield writes, since at least the time of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, anti-Semitism has gone hand in hand with anti-Masonry. So it is not surprising that allegations that 11 September was a Zionist plot have been accompanied by suggestions that the attacks were inspired by a Masonic world order. They're taking over.
They're taking over. Get ready. Well, guys, we actually have about 4 minutes left. So do you have any last alibis?
The Masons are trying to take over.
Well, we'll look at that, buddy.
I don't think
they've already taken over. They're already. It is important to note that I think what like almost like every president or like most presidents have been Freemasons.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think almost all the founding fathers were Freemasons as well.
A lot of them, yeah.
Oh, they've got their hands in a lot of cookie jars, if you know what I mean.
They got their hands in a lot of cookie jars. Mixed fun.
I think we should try to definitely do more investigations into Masonic temples because I think we would see a lot.
You think?
I mean, I'm just saying.
Was this spitball in there?
I mean, no. You know me. I'm always looking for ghosts.
God. Okay. All right. Well, I think we are going to make this into a two-parter. We're just going to push the second part to after what we already have scheduled. So you'll have to keep in store for the second part of the Freemasonry series for everybody that's listening out there. And with that, okay. I guess we will go.
I don't want to
get At least this
week we didn't have any disgusting pictures of like worms with razor sharp teeth.
I like the worms. Did you want to pull that up for you? Did you want us to?
No, I already have
I'm sure there's a connection.
I already have to look at it every time I pull up Facebook Messenger and I look at our group because the pictures show up and it's like the top picture that's in there. It's just a bloody worm with teeth. Like, good. I'm reminded of it every time.
And the Knight Templar. Let's see.
Fighting giant worms.
You know what? That is some art that I need to see. Like, just a full... this is probably the wrong military word, and I'm sure y'all will correct me. Battalion of Templar Knights fighting, like, just massive sea lampreys.
But yeah, we should commission something to get that drawn up.
I'm sure some sort of fan art already exists somewhere.
Probably. That is what I need to see. New mission.
The next piece of art that's commissioned is like me holding a freaking teethed worm while it's trying to bite me in the face.
This is already going downhill. So let's call it a night.
Yep. All right. Well, guys, have a good week ahead of you, and we will see you again next Tuesday.
Peace out.